What I would like to do, if I can just tell you a little bit of who I am, as you can hear, I'm not from this country originally. I originally trained in medicine and psychiatry in England, and then worked for a while with the La Brie Fellowship, which is a community and study center in the south of England, modeled on the work of Francis and Edith Schaeffer, La Brie in Switzerland, that you may have heard a little bit about. I worked there partly pastoring a local church, helping to do that, and partly involved in counseling and teaching within the community. And then 12 years ago, came here to teach at Covenant Seminary, Presbyterian seminary that you know about here in the city of St. Louis. I'm thankful for a gracious invitation to share with you in this conference. I have followed with interest the research on homosexuality for many years, and have been involved along the way in counseling people who've struggled with homosexual desire and tendencies. It's a huge subject, and we've covered many areas, and you're tired at the end of a day. I'm afraid I'm going to give you quite a lot of material, bits and pieces of which have come at you in other lectures, because I'd like to just review a sort of bird's eye view of the research, to distill it out, give you something of the essence of this. And one website that I would point to you, which is at the end of the handout, which we're getting more of those, by the way, hopefully in a moment, is NARTH, N-A-R-T-H, www.narth. It's a very helpful, which gives lots of details of the research that I will be quoting to you. Now, this, of course, is not just an academic or purely theological subject. It touches our lives, our identity, our sexuality very deeply. And there may be people, I'm sure there are people in this conference who have struggled themselves with homosexual thoughts, desires, relationships. And as pastors and as counselors and whoever you are, we need to come to terms with our own sexuality, first of all. But let's reflect together a little bit on some of the statistics, the research that has been done in this area. And I want to reflect for a few moments on the question of how common it is. You know of Kinsey's studies way back in the 40s, where he said that 10% of the population were homosexual. At least that's what people claimed, he said. And of course, since then, we have a very different figure. But Kinsey himself actually said that 4% of white males are exclusively homosexual, and that 10% of white males are more or less exclusively homosexual during at least 3 years. So he wasn't saying that 10% are exclusively homosexual. And of course, Kinsey had all sorts of problems with his methodology, using very biased samples of the population, like students and prison population and so on. I heard there's a movie coming out about Kinsey just, I think, this week, it's opening. But in the 1990s came a very different figure, what was popularly called the shrinking 10%, although the 10% is still quoted very widely in the gay media and the popular press. And recent studies have brought this figure down to about 1 to 2% of males are exclusively homosexual and 0.3 to 1% in females. Laumann, in his research, suggests that an occurrence of a homosexual relationship, which may be just a one-off thing, of same-gender sex, 3 to 6% in men, 1 to 3% in women. And then some attraction, 6% in men, 4% in women. So that the total of all those figures would be somewhere around 10% of the population who certainly feel some attraction, some conflict perhaps in this area. Now, Kinsey's scale, I'm going to come back to again because it's used in the research. Kinsey talked about people being either, he talked about people on a scale from exclusive heterosexuality, where they have no homosexual thoughts, dreams, fantasies, desires, awareness at all. That would be a zero on the Kinsey scale, to a six, which would be exclusively homosexual, where there is no heterosexual dream, fantasy, thought, desire at all. And I think what Kinsey was pushing for, and many people in our culture are pushing for, is something like this, that the normal distribution curve, they would say, is most people are bisexual. Now, there are few at one end of the spectrum who are exclusively homosexual, few at the other end are exclusively heterosexual, but what we are really pushing for is a recognition that people are basically can choose whichever way they want to go. As Dr. Bagamale says in his book Biological Exuberance, sexualities are multiple, gender is kaleidoscopic, male and female, fluid and transmutable. And here you get this idea of the sort of the gay, lesbian, bisexual, transsexual questioning, the GLBTQ alliance, pushing a new model of sexuality into the culture, that we're all a bit of one or the other and we should experiment. I think just from observation of people that most of us find that this figure of 1-2% of men being homosexual rings true. Unless you live in San Francisco or live in the Central West End in St. Louis, then it seems like the whole population is gay, or at least 10, 20, 30%. There is this group of people, if the far left-hand end of that is the 1-2%, then there is this area maybe of 5 to 10, 15% who are bisexual, confused, and uncertain about their identity, their gender identity, sexual orientation. And this figure, I think, probably is being expanded because of the cultural influences and the acceptance. But the figure of exclusively homosexual still seems to remain down 1 to 2, 3%. And then the vast bulk of the population, maybe 80 to 90%, are exclusively heterosexual. So let's look then at the factors that seem to shape homosexuality, genetic, psychological, sociological factors. In the world in which we live, which is sort of somewhere between the world of modernism and postmodernism, we live in both, with both influences, both rivers flowing through our culture. Modernism being the view that there is a scientific explanation for the cause of homosexuality, and if we can find that, we'll know exactly why it is. Postmodernism being that we create our own identity. And it's not the modern view being it's essentially part of your nature. The postmodern being the social constructionist view that you can create your own identity. You can be whoever you want to be. But it's a matter not of constitution, which would be the essentialist modernist view. I don't have a choice, I'm gay, I'm born that way, it's genetic. Or the other view would be, I can be whatever I want to be. And I think most people, young people in our culture are caught between those two views. And they swing from one, often from one to the other, not knowing quite which to believe. Because I think both of them reflect part of reality, part of God. And you need a theological Christian worldview that overarches these two, that gives an understanding of the place of both. So let's look then at the genetic evidence. Much that I could quote, but just to zone in on a few. The twin research is, of course, critical in this area. We're looking at, particularly back in the early 90s, a lot of genetic major research that came out in the media, obviously, as the gay gene, homosexuality is genetic, which was a distortion of those studies. That's not exactly what they said. But Bailey and Pillard, perhaps the most famous of these, this study, suggested that in their first study that the concordance rate for male homosexuals was 52% in identical twins. So if you have one identical twin who is gay, then there's a 52% chance that the other one will be too. And in females, a second study, 48%, compared with non-identical twins, 22% male, 16% concordance rate in female. There was a problem in that they were finding these twins through advertisements in gay magazines and other places. So there was a sample bias in this particular study. A second study, which had much less sample bias, it was done with the Australian twin population. They have about, I think it's about 1,400 pairs of identical twins, all sorts of studies being done on them. Bailey took his questionnaire to them and found a considerably lower figure of 20% male and 24% female concordance rate in identical twins. And you can see here from these studies that even if it's 50% concordance, it still leaves another 50% which isn't to do with genes. So you can't immediately say it's all genetic, even from his first study, if that was accurate. But I've mentioned that there was some of the problems of sample bias in his study. A second problem was the definition of homosexuality. And as I understand it, in his first study, he defined anyone as homosexual who was anywhere from 1 to 6 on the Kinsey scale. So that even some leaning in that direction was defined as homosexual. Now, that wasn't true, I think, in the later studies. It was also pointed out by other researchers that there were pretty major statistical errors in the way the information was processed. And this is well reported in Stanton Jones and Mark Yarhouse's book, Homosexuality, the Use of Scientific Research in the Church's Moral Debate. They have quite a large section on the twin studies in that. And what they point out is the actual concordance rate in the first study for male identical twins is 34% if you correct for the statistical errors, whereas they had claimed it was 52%. And in the second study, even lower, 11%, where Bailey was claiming it was 20%. And Bailey himself acknowledges these statistical problems later on. And he says in 2000, this 2000 study did not provide statistically significant support for the importance of genetic factors. So this study is still spoken about as if it's a 50% genetic likelihood. Now, Dean Hamer, in the 90s, came out with this idea that there's a gay gene, particularly in men, a region of the X chromosome in a small group of gay men. And again, other researchers have not been able to replicate this finding, although the idea still floats around. Now, in my own thinking about this, I think it is quite possible that there is a genetic factor. After all, so much of our personality and behavior is influenced by our genes. But that doesn't mean it's all genetic. It's just a genetic influence, and some people may be more strongly predisposed towards this than in others. And it could be that this comes through in terms of temperament. We'll look in a few moments at this idea that some people have a particular temperament that predisposes them. They're more men who may be more effeminate in childhood and so on. It maybe affects their hormones in some way. It may be that it's their neurochemistry that is disrupted, affected in an adverse way. And of course, from a Christian perspective, if there is a genetic influence, whatever way it comes through, we have to ask the question, is, what we see, what we discover, what necessarily ought to be? Don't we have to think in terms of creation and fall here? That even though we see maybe a genetic influence, it doesn't mean that this is what God necessarily planned or built into us. This is part of the radical disruption that came into the world through Adam and Eve's sin that affected the very, I think, physical structure of the creation in some way, even our genes and our chromosomes. Now back to this idea of temperament and gender nonconformity. It is said that men who are somewhat effeminate in childhood, women who are more masculine and butch, are more likely to become homosexual. This idea of the sissy, the tomboy, the feeling different. One young man that I saw some years ago whose father was a Texan football player, and this young man was blessed with incredibly creative artistic gift, highly sensitive aesthetically, a pianist, but his dad just called him a sissy because he was a musician, not a football player. And this young man found the affection that he was looking for from his dad and the affirmation, he found it within the gay community from other men who loved him, affirmed him, but then, of course, also got sexually involved with him. In a study in San Francisco of 71% of gay men and 70% of women, among 1,500 men and women felt different from same-sex peers in childhood compared with 38% of the men and 38% of heterosexual men and 51% of heterosexual women. So there was a felt difference as they looked back. Now, of course, there's always the problem here of distortion of your past. Is this actually a retrospective recreation of their past to sort of justify current identity? But again, I think there is some real truth in this. I think that people who do not fit the caricature stereotype of masculinity and femininity in our culture do tend to get pushed or pulled towards the gay culture. Many of the best restaurants are run by gay men or women. My wife is a floral designer, and many of the people that she works alongside in the business are gay men, profoundly creative, aesthetically wonderfully sensitive. But where do they find their identification? It's not with the football players and the jocks out there. So maybe some influence here. Now then we move to the question of prenatal hormones. Some animal studies you hear about where sex hormones or testosterone is injected into pregnant rats, and then you find that the young male rats who come out tend to mate in a homosexual way. They will mount other males. Now, how you extrapolate that to human sexual orientation from rat mounting behavior stretches the imagination. But it's possible that perhaps some women who have been taking hormones in pregnancy for some reason, it might affect the environment of that very sensitive brain developing around the age of 2 or 3 months in the womb. It's a very sensitive environment. Could it be that stress in pregnancy, there's been some research done on women who have been very stressed, and that it's claimed that there's a higher incidence of homosexuals in their offspring? Could it be the environmental hormones that we take in the toxins and so on, in cow's milk, in beef, in chicken, in eggs? Could this be affecting people in some way, the fetal environment, especially in pregnant mothers? It's possible, I think. Then you have the neuroanatomical differences. The differences, these three particular studies, again, the early 90s, a spate of these studies, suggesting that in gay men, a certain nucleus of the brain, the hypothalamus, which is related to sexual orientation, that nucleus in gay men is the same size as it is in women, and not the same size as it is in heterosexual men. These studies claim this. Other people have tried to replicate this study, have not been able to, for one thing. Another thing is that the problem of in the methodology is that all the people, the gay men, whose brains were looked at after death were people who had died from AIDS. Now, could it be that the AIDS process itself had affected what was found on the autopsy of the brain? I think perhaps even more significantly is this question of brain plasticity. We've been finding in the last 10 to 20 years that the brain actually changes according to our behavior. So it's not that the brain is a particular shape, size, it is to some degree that, but the more you indulge in a certain type of behavior, the more you're involved, say, in an obsessive compulsive ritual, the more that part of the brain related to that changes in shape, or the more you're involved in an addiction, say, to heroin or cocaine, the brain actually changes. So it could be, is it a matter of cause or effect? Is the brain a different size, this nucleus, because this person has been involved in a particular lifestyle, or is the difference in size the cause of the lifestyle? It's hard to know. Then, of course, we come on to psychobiological factors. The first sexual experience. We know that there are certain critical learning periods in the brain. A child learns to read at the age of 6, around 6, much better than they do at any other time, because their brain is ready for it, what we call the critical learning period. Could it be that the first sexual experience in puberty, if it is with another boy or another young man, or another older man, shapes the direction in which sexuality will develop? And if they go on in that homosexual lifestyle, it's much harder to turn back. One of the people in this area, researchers in this area, quotes the example of the white-crowned sparrow, a rather strange relationship to homosexual men and women. But he claims that the white-crowned sparrow, if it is removed from its nest early on when it's learning to sing the white-crowned sparrow song, it's put with other species who have a different song. It learns their song at the critical learning period for the brain. And later on, if you take it back amongst white-crowned sparrows, it can't unlearn the new song and learn the old song. The first experience of song learning was in one environment. It's harder to change back. Again, possible causation and perhaps maintenance of homosexual lifestyle. And another factor in all this, of course, is the area of compulsion and addiction. Sexual pleasure, orgasmic pleasure, is probably the most powerful pleasurable experience known to men and women. Not surprisingly, we return to it again and again. Not surprising that many, many men become addicted to sex. Men, about 90% of men are, of the sexual addicts are men, increasing number of women addicts, both heterosexual and homosexual. But men tend to be, as you know, far more promiscuous homosexually than women. Women much more concerned about relationship, men more concerned about getting their sexual needs met in the context, perhaps, of relationship. But they have many more relationships than women do. But there is an addictive quality to all of sex, whether it's heterosexual or homosexual, that once you're involved in this lifestyle, it's hard to get out again. Then the psychological factors of the family. Now, going back in time, of course, before the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, the DSM of 1973, was changed to define homosexuality as now normal, before 1973 it was abnormal. The psychoanalysts, especially, for instance, Freud, saw it as a form of developmental arrest. Something had gone wrong in the phases of early childhood development. So it was an abnormality, could be fixed perhaps through therapy. Irving Bieber, another analyst, saw it as a result of a hidden fear of the opposite sex, which again could be perhaps fixed by analysis. More recently, the research mostly on homosexual men comes out with this, the caricature, familiar pattern of parenting. And I think any dysfunctional family has obviously some influence here. But the particular pattern that one does see quite frequently in people struggling with a homosexual tendency is that mothers of these young men tend to be over-involved, tend to be more demanding, tend to perhaps be too intimate, getting some of their emotional needs met in the relationship with the son that they should be getting in marriage. And fathers tend to be distant, emotionally avoidant, or absent for whatever reason. So that the young man then goes out trying to fill the hole in his soul, which should have been filled by the relationship with his father. Or the young woman goes out looking for it in the relationship that she didn't have with her mother. So it is a deficit in the relationship with the same-sex parent, not the opposite-sex parent so much, but the same-sex parent. And there is what is called by Elizabeth Mobley a same-sex ambivalence that arises out of this. A defensive detachment that, again, pushes the young man or the young woman out to look for the relationship in the wrong places, with trying to get their needs met that should have been met in childhood with someone of the same sex. Another area in the psychological which I think drives people towards homosexuality, away from heterosexuality, is abuse, sexual abuse. And just to go through this pretty quickly here, there is certainly a considerably higher incidence reported of, in terms of recall of abuse, of abuse amongst homosexual men and women than amongst heterosexual men and women. You can see from these figures here, so around 40% homosexual men, 2% heterosexual men by comparison. And the age of that abuse, the boys was the mean age was 13, the girls was around 11. So not surprisingly, I think that that should push people, especially if it is abuse in the context of family or close relationships, that should push them into relationship with the same sex. Now, the broader factors here, the social, cultural, wider factors that you've heard a lot about in the lectures already. Relativism, of course, tolerance of the homosexual lifestyle. This is the cultural environment that allows and encourages homosexuality. The teaching in schools that encourages young people to experiment, to think that it's normal, political correctness, and of course intolerance towards a Christian viewpoint which says that homosexuality is abnormal or wrong or sinful. All of these are things, I think, creating an environment. So we see then in summary here that we live in a fallen world. Through the sin of Adam and Eve, all sorts of disruptions have come into the world, such as genetic abnormalities, environmental toxins, and so on. Not only do we live in the shadow of the fall, we live in a world where people sin against each other in all sorts of ways, where parents neglect their children, where fathers and mothers become alcoholics or sex addicts and have a distorted relationship with their young children, where there is abuse of young children. And then on top of all of this, of course, we ourselves in our own hearts deeply bent towards sin, so that we find our own needs met in wrong ways. Legitimate longings, perhaps, we get satisfied in wrong relationships. The desires that we have become demands for having sexual satisfaction. The longings that we have, God-given longings, become lusts. Rebellion and pride come out in idolatry, as we say, I want things my way, not God's way. We replace God with a person or with an idolatry of sexuality itself. So let me summarize all of this with this diagram to show you both the external, and what I'm saying here is that it's all of the, any of these influences, if all of them are there, then the likelihood of someone being homosexual or having a homosexual orientation is pretty high, obviously. If it's just a few, then the likelihood is less. Most of the secular psychological researchers now are saying the same thing. The media and Ann Landers are not. They're still saying it's genetic or it's biochemical or can't help it. Most of the scientific research is saying it's an interactional, multi-causational model that we need to go towards. And the Christian, of course, adds all the internal heart dynamics that you have here of pride and lust and idolatry and our own sin that interacts with the ways in which we've been sinned against and the fallen world in which we live. Now, I want to go on to talk about the question of change and is it possible. Let me pause for a moment if you have any urgent questions out of what I've said already.
Paul Peckman, a question not about ideology but about longevity of homosexuals. Are there any real statistics or studies that are accurate about that?
Yeah, I don't know figures on that, but I do know that incidence of a lot of mental and physical diseases and disorders is higher amongst the homosexual population. Now, of course, they would say, well, that's just because we're discriminated against, and if we had our freedom to be married and do all these other things that we want to do, then we wouldn't suffer all those disorders. But if we would, as we would believe that if this is an abnormality, something that is not the way they are supposed to live, that they are pushing against the very boundaries of God's created order, then it's not surprising that they have higher rates of depression, of suicide, of sexually transmitted diseases. And of course, with the higher incidence of sexually transmitted diseases, especially AIDS, then their lifespan is going to be shorter. So yes, you know, all of these things, I think, come in to answer your question. The question about change. This very clever covers of Newsweek, you may have noticed it when they came out, but on the newsstands that where I was buying my copy, alternate copies were men and women on the same day. They came out like this. Obviously, the movement is to say, well, change is not possible. These people are born this way. They can't change. So surely we should give them all the rights, recognize them as the way God has created us, and not see it as abnormal at all. And the strong tendency of the gay movement and the American Psychological Association, the American Counseling Association, is to say that it is completely wrong for us to try to help people to change because there is no evidence that change happens. They've made moves to have what we call conversion therapy or reorientation therapy banned as unethical, unenlightened, ineffective, prejudiced, and homophobic. So they would encourage us to do gay affirmative therapy, but not to enter into any sort of reorientation therapy, because you are actually doing people a disservice, you're making them sicker than they were before. It would be unethical. And I would ask the question, if these people are so concerned about choice and diversity, where is their concern about choice and diversity on this issue? Now, when we look at change in this, we need to ask, what is the definition of change? Are we talking about change that is from exclusive Kinsey 6 homosexuality to married with two kids in a sort of average American family with no homosexual leanings at all? That's not what we're talking about here in most of the research. We're talking about a spectrum of change, a gradual movement from one to the other. And that's a very important thing to stress when we're talking about the evidence for it. So what evidence is there for change? Now, I mentioned before 1973, there were actually quite a lot of studies that were done. And I'm going to give you a lot of figures here just to look at on the screen. I'm not going to read them all out. These are just a sampling of some of the studies that were done in the 60s and the 70s and up into the 90s, a survey looking back. Most of these studies are done of psychoanalytic, psychodynamic type of therapy. So this is long-term, twice-a-week type, in-depth therapy. And they all claim change of some sort in their therapy. Most of this is from therapists' reports of the change, and there are certain methodological problems, of course, with that, as with some other methodological problems with it. But notice that this is an average of 4 years in therapy in that last study there. The methodological problems, the average positive outcome, that's not a problem there really, but just to summarize this, the average positive outcome in these studies is 33%. An interesting figure, because that's roughly the figure that you'd come up with if you look at change in alcoholics or people with severe depression. A third would be completely better, completely changed. A third would be on the way, and a third would not be changed at all. Rough figures. Now, I mentioned this is from therapist reports. There's a possible mislabeling of hetero and homosexual. At what point on the Kinsey scale do you call it homosexual? Is it 4 to 6, or is it 2 to 6, or just 6? What's the definition of change? We've looked at that already. How are these followed up? Is this just for 6 months after the therapy, or a year, or 5 years? And the studies varied in terms of their follow-up length of time. And with these studies, there were very few control groups. And of course, it's hard. What control groups do you use for this sort of therapy? Now, when you look at more recently, back in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, studies of behavioral therapy, cognitive therapy, and group therapies, again, you come up with a figure, the average positive outcome around 33%. So what we're saying here is that some change is possible. Some change is possible. Now, again, let me remind you of the Kinsey scale, because this is used in the research a number of times. So now we move from the secular, non-religiously oriented approaches to some studies done particularly of Christians and by Christians. The Pattersons in the American Journal of Psychiatry back in 1980. Yeah, this is a psychiatrist couple, and they describe a study where they selected out of 200 cases that they reviewed, selected 30, and then they interviewed 11 of these men in depth. And before the study, 9 of these were at the level of K6, 9 exclusively homosexual, before they entered into a therapeutic change process that I'll describe in a moment. After this process, 5 of them were a Kinsey 0, exclusively heterosexual, 3 K1, 3 Okay, two, six were married. Now, I'm sure some relapsed, as they many of the pro-gay people claim, after this study. The same would be true if you looked at a group of alcoholics. Some would relapse afterwards. But they describe this. They say, when our subjects came in contact with the church's crisis service for homosexuals, they found a welcome reception as homosexuals. And this was a Pentecostal church that had a street ministry and a crisis service for homosexuals. And this was a Pentecostal church that wasn't into instant healing, rather gradual healing. No attempt was made to make them change their homosexuality. Rather, they were presented with the invitation to commit their life to Christ and the church. All subjects had an explicit Christian conversion or dedication. They were then invited into small church fellowship groups where they studied the Bible and learned expected biblical patterns of mature lifestyles. All of our subjects soon became aware that they were psychologically immature and had poor interpersonal relationships. They were surprised to experience acceptance, non-judgmental evaluation, and non-erotic love from both men and women. These were new relationships, and as a result, they began to identify with those they considered mature Christian men and women, and to experience and practice non-erotic relationships with Christian women in the church. There was no immediate change in their homosexual dreams, fantasies, impulses, or orientation. Rather, a gradual maturation into a secure and satisfying identity as a male with high self-acceptance. They began to experience non-threatening and satisfying interpersonal relationships with women, resulting in a steady diminution in their homosexual feelings and a steady increase in their heterosexual feelings. Now, that seems to me to be the pattern of all the reorientation types of therapies that we look at, whether it's in a counseling relationship or a counseling relationship and a community of the church, which is ideally what it should be. The movement is a gradual change. We are being sanctified. We are being changed after our justification. The work of the Spirit in us, the work of the community of the body of believers, this is all part of a process that you enter into. And the research seems to bear this out. Nicol Ozai in 1998, Nicol Ozai and Satanova being two of the biggest names in this area, of 882 religious people were seeking change who had experienced change. 78% of these were men, 22% women. The average age of awareness of their homosexual tendencies was 12 and a half years. 82% of them were in therapy with a professional therapist or a pastoral counselor. The other 18% were just getting support from friends, family, and an ex-gay ministry. And he found that 68% of these were exclusively or almost exclusively homosexual at one time in their lives. So this is their Kinsey 5 or 6. Only 13% perceived themselves in this manner after therapy. 35% were unsuccessful in making the change. So here we have again this a third perhaps who don't manage to change at all, a third who make quite dramatic change, and a third somewhere in between. The average age of entering therapy was almost 30. And the average length of therapy, note this, 3.4 years. Now, this is where we're talking about long-term to help anyone change for any deeply addictive behavior. It's not just a few weeks, a few months. This is an ongoing thing that you enter into over time, part of the process of sanctification. And just to give you the Kinsey scale here, just very briefly, the ones who are exclusively homosexual, the K6, 37% of them, 5% of them were K6 after the therapy. Those who were K5, 31%, 8% of them were after the therapy, and so on. But you can see, again, there's a spectrum of change here in these figures. And what all of these people say happened to them was that there was this gradual decrease in homosexual thoughts, fantasies, masturbation, and overt homosexual behavior. There was an improvement in overall psychological health, and 99% of these people believed that homosexual orientation can be changed. Now, most of these, of course, are Christian, and I think to summarize the key things that come out of these studies, change is difficult. Change is difficult. All the people I have worked with, change has been difficult. They need strong motivation, and obviously it is the Christian who has the strongest motivation. You have a belief that there is something wrong, inherently wrong, with this orientation, and where there is change is easier if involvement in active homosexual practice is minimal. The longer you've been involved in any behavior, any thought pattern, the harder it is to change out of that because it becomes more like an addiction. And if there has been some heterosexual fantasy or attraction or experience, in other words, if you are, say, K3 or K2 on the Kinsey scale, rather than K6, then change is obviously going to be a little bit easier. And overall, as Satanova, as Nicolosi, other men, women that work in this area say, they admire the courage and commitment of men and women who enter into this process. They need to be treated as men and women with great dignity, even though they also suffer with great depravity and brokenness. So we have Patterson, we have Nicolosi, another study done in the Exodus community, which again shows a change. 64% of 140 men and women reported behavioral change. I'm not going to go into this. This wasn't actually therapy. This was just being involved in an ex-gay movement or care within the church, a group that was helping them out. So again, you don't necessarily need a therapist or a counselor, although I think that is an additional help. But the one I really want to come to before I finish here is Robert Spitzer. Now, he is a psychologist who was very instrumental in the 1973 APA vote to remove homosexuality from the list of disorders in the DSM. He was one of the moving voices in this. And he was speaking at an APA meeting a few years ago, and he noticed, he couldn't help but notice, all the protesters outside who were saying that change is possible. Most of these were Christians who had been through some of the reorientation therapies that I've described. So he noticed all their posters here, thousands have changed, it's possible. And he was so intrigued by this that he decided to do research on them. And his paper that he eventually got published just a short while ago, he had a great difficulty getting it published because it was not exactly politically correct in the professional journal circle. Out of a larger group, interviewed 143 men and 57 women in a 45-minute telephone interview. And these men and women had to have been had to have had a pretty strong sort of Kinsey 5 or 6 homosexual orientation and then been involved in 5 years of sustained effort to change to come into this study. And he found that 66% of the men and 44% of the women who had rarely or never felt any opposite sex attraction now had good heterosexual function, and there was a spectrum of change. And he concluded, contrary to conventional wisdom, some highly motivated individuals using a variety of change efforts can make substantial change in multiple indicators of sexual orientation and achieve good heterosexual functioning. And he has become one of the major voices against the APA and ACA view that we should ban reorientation therapy. So he says, the mental health professionals should stop moving in the direction of banning therapy that has as a goal a change in sexual orientation. The ability to make such a choice for therapy should be considered fundamental to client autonomy and self-determination. So the tide is moving back again in the APA circles, thankfully, due to this man. And I'm thankful, too, that it's not just Christians who have done the research on the change, because it gives more authenticity to our perspective. Because, as you know, both sides can misuse statistics. Same with the abortion debate. Both sides, pro and anti, can misuse statistics. Let me say a brief word then about how to help. What you saw, the model that I described in the church, ideally we welcome people who are struggling with their homosexual identity into the church as fellow sinners, just as we are. We are broken, bent people in all sorts of ways. We offer them friendship. We build bridges to the gay community. When they threaten us, we invite them to dinner, whatever it is that you do. And we share the gospel of God's love and grace and forgiveness with them. And for people who accept the gospel, who begin to believe and to understand that they need to change, that there is something wrong, and Brian Salmonen, in his workshop this morning, went into much more detail about counseling for pastors in this area. You need to give time for this to sink in. You don't expect instant change after repentance. You expect slow change as with any other besetting sin. And then you encourage people into, not just into a counseling relationship with you as a pastor or a counselor, although that may be very important, but into other non-erotic same-sex friendships and wholesome opposite-sex friendships. You encourage people into families and into community. This may be the first friendship that a gay man or a gay woman has ever had with someone of the same sex which is not erotic, not sexualized. That is a new experience and a difficult one to learn how to manage, how to get into. And of course, teaching from the pulpit, teaching in small groups, in counseling settings, prayer, warning those who persist in their homosexual lifestyle after a long time of being beginning to understand grace. But as Paul says in 1 Thessalonians 5:14, we need to encourage and help and be patient with the timid and with the weak. And it may be that discipline is needed within the church, but only for those who are persistently and openly rebellious against God and the church. Now, if the church is a hospital, and it's obviously many things, it's family, it's army, it's hospital, but if it is a hospital in some way, some intensive care counseling may be needed for a while. Support groups, I think, are incredibly important. And I've given you a list of one or two things at the very end. But First Light is a group. I'm on the board of First Light here in St. Louis. We have two groups for homosexual men running at the moment, meet once a week for support, for accountability, for teaching. One group that meets for women that is associated with First Light, and one group of men that meets for people who are struggling with pornography and sexual addiction, mostly heterosexual men in that group. And these men need that sort of support. They cannot go it alone. It's hard to go it alone. It's hard to deal with it just as pastor and someone who's struggling. They need a wider context for healing. So groups, parachurch ministries like Exodus, like First Light, like Harvest Ministries in Philadelphia, who have pioneered quite a lot of this work. And then just a few words here to conclude about individual counseling. Some themes that I find myself picking up in counseling. And again, Brian Salmonen went into a lot more detail. If you're interested in this, getting his handout from his workshop. But I mentioned this, so many people who are struggling with homosexual longings and desires for someone of the same sex need to recognize that this is rooted in a legitimate longing for relationship with someone of the same sex. But it has been met in a destructive and inadequate and wrong way, like the young man who longed for relationship with his father, but he was musical, aesthetic, a disappointment to his dad who didn't want to affirm him in that, so he finds his longings, legitimate longings, met in the wrong context. And as one comes to realize what's happened in the past, what has shaped you into this identity, then you need to grieve those poor relationships within the family, the sinful relationships that you got involved with, getting the needs met in the wrong way. Uncovering, becoming aware of the sinful strategies for meeting those needs and longings. Facing and admitting anger. It may be that there is anger in many gay men and women. There is a deep anger, bitterness, resentment towards parents who should have met their legitimate longings in a better way. Now, no parent is perfect, but one can understand in many of these people's situations why they feel angry. So you have to help them to tease out what is legitimate righteous anger and what is unrighteous anger in the way they express it and how they deal with it in the present. That they need to know what it means to repent before God of their own sin and learn to leave justice, as Romans 12 says, "Vengeance is mine, I will repay." Our responsibility is dealing with our own anger, asking forgiveness for that, learning to forgive those who have sinned against us, and leaving justice to God. We don't need to take revenge or get justice ourselves. And learning to depend on God for his view, what he thinks of us, rather than what other people think of us, as the source of our identity and value and worth. Accepting that we have been forgiven, and that may mean that we have to come back again and again to the foot of the cross. Forgiving others for past hurt, and that the counselor and the pastor model God's grace in offering absolution and forgiveness. But I think it's also important to help the person struggling with this to separate out guilt and shame, to understand that even though they may have been forgiven and the guilt is dealt with, yet they may still feel shame. And shame is harder to erase than guilt. It's a deep sense that I am a flawed person. Not just that I've done something wrong, but I am a deeply damaged, flawed person. And shame, I think, is healed through acceptance. The prodigal son was forgiven by his father, and he wanted just to be like one of the servants. He said, make me like one of your hired servants. And the father said, no, get up, you are my son. We're going to party. He accepted him, he forgave him, but also accepted him and dealt with his shame in that way. So acceptance of other believers is really important. And then, of course, the tough business of breaking old habits of thought and action, resisting temptation, being careful about where you go on the internet. Many of these people who struggle with sexual sin have had to not have an internet connection for a while, get rid of their television, because there are so many images that are too difficult for them to handle. Being careful about where they go in the city, what magazines they read, what movies they go to. It's a whole change of culture, subculture and lifestyle. And therefore, the church needs to be a community that offers an alternative, that is attractive, that is warm, that is embracing, that draws them in helping them to resist temptation. Now, I've given you some references at the end of the handout there, which in relation to people who describe this change, both for men and women. There are two there, Out of Egypt and Restoring Sexual Identity, both in relation to lesbianism. One for parents, Parents' Guide to Preventing Homosexuality by the Nicolosis, and then others with some of the organizations and websites, NARTH being the one I mentioned at the beginning. First Light, here is the telephone number and the website of First Light if you're interested in an organization locally here that is trying to help. Now, I have used up, I think, all my time here, but if people have questions, I'm happy to hang around for a few minutes. And yes, please.
Dennis Niels, I'm a pastor in Alaska, and I've not worked a lot with homosexual people, but a lot with people who have been sexually abused, and I can't help but see some significant parallels between the treatment or the desire for change in this situation and people who have been sexually abused as children or as adults.
Yeah, that's right. I think there are real parallels. I mean, there are many parallels to dealing with anyone who is dealing with a dysfunctional family background of any sort. Many of the same themes that I've talked about that you go through in the process of counseling and therapy will be there. You know, how you deal with anger, forgiveness, justice. It's all in there, isn't it? And the fact that it is a long-term process of healing, not just a quick fix when they come to Christ. Yeah.
As you mentioned the internet, I just wanted to mention, Dr. Salmanen mentioned www.covenanteyes.com.
Yes.
I've also heard of www.xxxchurch.com, that latter one being a free service to monitor such internet to keep you accountable with someone. Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't know about that last one, but the Covenant Eyes website is a website you can go to and you sign on. It does cost, I think Brian said, $7 or $9 a month or something. But it is a wonderful way of accountability where you can name a partner who is going to be your accountability partner. And every month they get sent to them all the sites that you have visited on your computer in the last month. So you're voluntary opening yourself up to be seen where you've been. And that's a very valuable tool in the battle against temptation. Any other queries or comments, experiences you'd like to share on this? Have I confounded you? Yes. The question is, are there any statistics on success in relation to First Light, what we're doing there? Well, it's relatively new. It's only in the last year or so that we have got the groups off the ground, and the men in the groups and the women in the one group, from what I have heard of these men, many of them are finding it a very helpful support network. They're getting good teaching, good discussion, good prayer, good accountability with one another that is helping them on this long, hard road to break free. Quite a number of them are married too, and obviously dealing with that issue, in which we're thinking, hoping to be able to start a group to support the wives of people who are sexually addicted, or the wives even of people who are struggling with homosexuality. Ron Lutyens, who is here, who has just been speaking about the history of First Light and its development, has done a workshop on that. Do you want to say anything more, Ron, about than I've said about the sort of the way things are going in the groups?
Yeah, we've had the groups now for 2 years. And one of the things we need to do long term is to do some statistical work. The mother organization that our ministry is modeled after, Harvest USA in Philadelphia, has been doing this for about 20 years. All three of their full-time staff people are men, and actually there's a woman who works there now too, who struggled with same-sex attraction. And next time I talk to them, I'm going to ask them if they've done any statistical studies of, you know, how many people have gone back into the lifestyle. It's a good question.
There are lots of anecdotal stories, obviously, and then the studies that I have given you here. But it would be good to have some ongoing work with organizations like this, some research being done.
Richard, the one thing I might mention, our denomination puts out something on the email. And I just purchased a video cassette. I haven't looked at it yet, but it's called I Do Exist or We Do Exist. Mm-hmm. And it's testimonies of people who have come out of a gay lifestyle, kind of to rebut the prevailing consensus that all these Exodus ministries, they're really just bogus, that people really can't come out and stay out. It'll be interesting to see whether in these testimonies people talk about how long they've been out. But the guys in Harvest, for instance, John Freeman, who started Harvest, was a cross-dresser in high school. And while John would say that he continues to struggle with the temptation as he's grown in the grace of God, he would say that it's less intense. He still has to watch himself. But John's got a pretty long track record of not falling off the wagon, so to speak.
I think we need to stop here. We're getting the message. Other people are coming in for the next round, so thank you.